Welcome to Music Scene. I'm your host, Nanette Weiser. And boy, is it going to be a scene in October when the Clearwater Jazz Holiday returns to its roots in Coachman Park, October 16th through 19th. And as part of our partnership with Clearwater Jazz Holiday, we've been talking to a lot of musicians, and with me today is one of the legendary ones that will be there, Pete Carney from Retro Jazz Studies at State College of Florida. Welcome, Pete.
Hey, Nanette. Glad to be here.
Well, Pete, tell us a little bit about your history with Clearwater Jazz Holiday. I know you've performed before, so let's start with that before we do a little bit on your backstory.
Sure. I mean, I moved here from Chicago, where I was a saxophone player and touring musician there, and I moved down here to teach at State College of Florida and direct the jazz program. And one of the first people I met down here was Steve from Clearwater, and just meeting the organization, it's always been like a premier organization to me, and their chemistry of putting on high quality, you know, national acts with high quality local jazz mixed in with educational outreach. They really put the whole package together. And so Steve and I have always been working on education things and jazz concerts and however we can find a way to work together, generally speaking.
Well, and we know that Frank Williams, who is in our studio recording Stop Time, is a big part of this. I don't think people realize that the Clearwater Jazz Holiday is not just a festival. It supports the education initiative. So tell us a little bit about the importance of music, because you're seeing the kids who came up through the school.
Sure.
Yeah, tell us about jazz and education.
It's the premier organization in the state of Florida, and honestly, there's just not another organization around that does so much for the young musicians and kind of building that bridge from like their young high school experience or middle school even. You know, Clearwater goes into the schools and gives these kids opportunities to work with professionals, and it helps the teachers, you know, build a bridge for these great kids that are coming up. The kids get to meet what happens down the road, you know, and that experience can just be life-changing. I can remember when I was a kid, and when you met, like, the first jazz guy, it just, you didn't know that person really existed. It's like meeting a cartoon character when you're, they provide such a great resource to the community.
Well, you know, Chicago is funky town. I mean, our own Chico Freeman, of course, dear friend and
sure.
family come from there, just like the Marsalises are from New Orleans.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your backstory and why did you choose saxophone and who were great influences as you were growing up?
Sure. I mean, I grew up, you know, I would say for all of the, you know, all the saxophone players, I remember hearing Johnny Hodges from the Duke Ellington band, like, that was the first CD I bought as a kid, and I just listened to his solo on All of Me. It's just like this 3-minute solo, and then the band plays like 30 seconds at the end. And then from there, listening to David Sanborn and Kenny G and Grover Washington and John Coltrane, and just putting all these people together, all these different people speaking through the horn.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's so amazing, too, because you have performed with Grammy winners Kirk Franklin, Tito Puente, the Winans, and Plain White Tees. And as a band leader, Aberdeen Jazz Festival, Scotland, Rochester International Jazz Festival, Milwaukee Jazz, Halo. You've been featured on NPR, BBC, NBC. But you also have a book. Tell us about that new, you're the author of Interactive Listening, A New Approach to Music.
Sure. I mean, I've spent the majority of my career as a musician in Chicago, but I also love teaching. For me, it's always been a great balance. And like, honestly, it's just like it puts together the daytime and the nighttime, you know, because you teach during the day, and you get to play jazz or teach about music history. And I really enjoyed that part of it, because if you don't teach it and if you don't teach audiences, and which are at that time are students, if you don't teach them how to listen, then you don't have a next generation of audiences. So I was passionate about a textbook I created, and it's an app called Interactive Listening. And it went on to like win some awards with Apple, and we got a lot.
Number one, I think. Number one. Let me throw the kudo at you, my friend.
Sure, sure. They picked us as editor's choice, and it just did incredible publicity for our business that led it to, I ended up doing a TED talk about just designing education to get people's attention and designing curiosity. And how do we make music interesting for listeners to understand what they're hearing? And that caught the attention of a lot of public school teachers and international school teachers. And they ended up adopting it as a state textbook in Florida. And a lot of colleges use it because it was asking people to be involved in listening to music and make decisions about what they're hearing and try and write it down and write descriptions so that they could have a deeper feeling with it. You know, at the end of the day, music is inside of our own head. So if we can get audiences to listen to it through their own life, then you have a chance of them listening to it as listening to the performers in front of them, you know, because it's a shared experience, but it has to go through your own brain to make sense. There's no absolute music. You know, we all create it in our mind when we hear it.
Well, and, you know, that leads me to ask you. So, you know, I'm sure you play some original music, but you also play music. How do you make a song or music your own when you're playing a jazz piece? How do you approach that?
Yeah, that's interesting because, like, I think your life makes it. Like, everything you do all day or this week, it, like, you know, from making coffee or, you know, talking with people or the morning commute, like, all of these things have ended up in my songs. And you can only kind of see that when you look backwards. When you're actually writing it, you're kind of looking forwards and you feel like you're just writing music. But when I look back at what I wrote 5 years ago or 10 years ago, it's very much like a reflective of everything that was around me at the time. And as a musician and a composer, it's like your life just goes through the pencil, so to speak. And your life just kind of expresses itself in the most abstract way that makes perfect sense later on. But you don't really know why it's happening when you're writing it down the first time, you know.
Do you listen to music while you're composing music?
No, I think you kind of like imagine things, right? So you imagine things that are around, like if I'm writing a melody, then you kind of imagine a bass line that would go with it, or you can hear a drum groove in your head, and you're kind of building an imaginary world with a character that's usually the melody kind of walking through that imaginary world.
No wonder they say that you make jazz history fun. I think that you were just at the Palladium in St. Pete, is that right, with Peter Mongoya and James Fuchs? Did I get that right?
That's right. We did a concert with the SDF Jazz Orchestra, and they brought in Peter Mongoya as a guest to play all this Santana music. And James Fuchs, we did a special tribute to Chuck Mangione, who passed away this summer. So that was that was a real highlight for...
Who brought the flugelhorn?
James did. He doesn't bust it out that much, but he surprised us with his flugelhorn, which was fantastic.
Yeah, I saw Chuck Mangione many places, and that's a loss. And I think that you also, were you just at, I should call you Dr. Carney, by the way.
It's all right. Don't worry about it.
You in the SDF Jazz Ensemble to a fundraiser for the Flugelhorn Jazz Foundation?
That was the same concert. Yeah.
The Santana in the 70s. So what is it about the 70s that just seems to be like so engaging other Gen X and other generations right now?
Yeah, it is. And we could have a whole class of lecture about the jazz in the 70s because it's kind of like between decades in a lot of ways. You know, it's like real interesting between space to me. It's like you got the celebrity, you know, knows about Coltrane in the 60s and Miles in the 60s, and then Miles goes electric, and it's kind of controversial. But there's just like this mysteriousness to the 70s. I think that's what it is. It's like the beginning of something new that was more expansive than the 60s was maybe, you know, pushing back against society. And I feel like the 70s was like creating other worlds that were beyond just pushing back, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And music was very cinematic. It was like people were experimenting. All of a sudden, you know, it wasn't MTV yet, but people were like they were starting to make like movies,
right?
And you know, the Monkees. And although that's not jazz, I also think that some of the music was really cinematic and it told a story and more than a story. It like just was crazy. So let me ask you about Redline Groove, because I love this song. Tell me how this song came to be, and give us a little of the backstory on that.
Redline Groove was a song I wrote when I was kind of up and coming as a saxophone player in Chicago, and you're surrounded by all kinds of music in the city, you know, from Latin music to electronic music to house music to funk music to jazz and gospel and blues, of course. And so you're kind of living in that city, and all that music starting to rub off on me, where I'd just kind of been more of a jazz guy before that. The city has its influence on you, kind of like I was saying earlier, your life starts to come through it. So I wrote that song after I was riding on a train and I fell asleep, and I was kind of new in town. And the Red Line runs from 95th Street South all the way to Evanston on the north side. And so it goes through the whole city, and it never stops. It just keeps going night and day. And so I fell asleep on the Red Line and woke up at 95th Street. And then I woke up and then fell asleep on the other end. And as I kept waking up, the train got more and more interesting. So the characters on the train, you got people coming home from the clubs, or people that are just working the night shift, and or people that are just out looking for trouble or whatever. So it's kind of like that, like, youthful experience. I was a little bit in over my head.
I hear you. You know, honestly, when I listen to your stuff, you've got a lot of Latin, Latin flair to your music. Tell me a little bit about that influence.
Sure. So that came from my years in Miami, just working with, getting to play with people like Tito Puente and Arturo Sandoval, and just being a young musician in Miami, it rubs off on you. You can't really go back to playing jazz the same way after you live in any of these sort of big cities. Even if you go to Miami today, still there's a different sound in the jazz in Miami than there is like the jazz in Tampa or the jazz in
San Francisco, right? I mean, there's just it really is interesting how like the cool, laid back, you know, Vince Guaraldi or whatever kind of influences, you know, San Francisco, and then it gets hot, you know. You know, Rodolfo Troncoso and Marcus Gottschalk over at the Warehouse Arts District, they're doing a whole series on Latin music and Latin jazz. So tell me a little bit about why Latin jazz is having its moment.
It's, you know, they were separated from each other. You know, when jazz kind of gets going in New York City, it kind of gets going on its own, but Latin music is still going in Cuba and Puerto Rico. And they have been separated, but then, you know, they start because of Spanish Harlem, the neighborhoods, the African-American neighborhoods and the Latin neighborhoods really get mixed right next to each other. And Dizzy Gillespie is really one of the first people that said, let's put these two cousins back together. They've been always kind of connected since Dizzy Gillespie brought them back together. But it just never the excitement of the music and the diversity of the rhythms. It's like jazz. It has that welcomeness into itself, and jazz is also a welcoming type of music. So they've always been able to cross into each other's neighborhoods, so to speak.
So what can we expect when you come to the Clearwater Jazz Holiday this year? Tell us who's in your group and what you'll be performing, what people can expect to hear.
So it's a great group of like all the best players in Tampa Bay. We got Hiram Hazley and Mark on bass, and Mark Griffith playing drums. Mark Moltrip's playing keyboards. Chuck Stevens is playing guitar. Fernando Cruz is a new saxophone player in the area who's burning it up. He's playing in my group. Also, we got four horn players in the band, and Jackson Harp is also playing trumpet. So it's just a great group of all-star players. And I have a great singer, Alora Urexoy, who's a new young singer. She's singing up probably three or four tunes. We're doing, it's kind of like a mix of pop, jazz, Motown, and a little bit of Radiohead, to be honest with you.
Really?
So,
that's going to be fun.
Yeah, it's definitely... It's stuff from my new album called The Before Times, and it's kind of about like like the sound of Motown and the sound of things that I also haven't been live before times in Chicago. Like the music that you grow up on, the kind of heartbeat of like American Motown type grooves. So some of that, and then also some Radiohead to kind of mix it up, but interpret it as like an American sound instead of being like a British rock band. We're going to have like a jazz orchestra plays Radiohead.
That is very fun. And so the Before Time's new album, is that out now?
If not, we just finished recording it like a couple weeks ago, and we're mixing it right now and hoping to have some singles coming out before Christmas.
Can you share with us a couple of the names of the singles we can look forward to?
Yeah, sure. We've got one of the songs is called Penguin Skating, and that's kind of this imaginary ice skating rink with penguins on it, basically.
So, Dream time with Pete Carney.
Yeah, it's a little bit out there. What other songs we have? We have the Before Times, which, you know, the title track, it's based on the feeling we had before COVID, you know, and just trying to get back to the before times, like as a whole country. Like for me, it's like people, we just need to come together and accept our differences from one another and find positivity again. So for me, it's the Before Times.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. So what is next? I mean, who are you collaborating with? Or are you on the road with? Or where are you performing next? And is there a movie you want to score? I know that you actually did work on an HBO film project. I believe you worked on, not sure what. That was the question I was going to ask you earlier, because I heard from someone that you were working on a film score for something.
I don't think so. I teach film scoring at the college, but...
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, I've got an exciting year coming up. I'm going to be doing a concert with Lewis Nash, the famous drummer, and Rodney Whittaker and Pat Bianchi. They're all super heavy New York guys. And we're doing the Nash Institute in Phoenix. We're doing a week-long jazz workshop and concert series. I got asked to do that, so I'm pretty excited to be invited to that.
So that'll be in Phoenix, and when will that be?
Yeah, that'll be Phoenix in June, and it's just like just top-level musicians from around the world that are coming in to teach, and it's mostly for high school and mostly high school students, and then there's a week of concerts that go with that.
That's exciting. And so where would you like to play that you have not played? Chicago, New York, et cetera, et cetera. What would be, or a festival that you've got
I played at some smaller places in New York, you know, so that's always on my radar. There's just something about playing in New York that never gets old, you know, it's always fresh. It's always challenging. I have to tour and, you know, it's like, it's kind of the everywhere thing for me, because there's cool audiences everywhere. And so the more you get to meet those people, it's just an experience. I think that it never gets old. Like we've played in, you know, in Europe and in the Caribbean and everything. And it's just, people are the same in general. And the more of them you get to meet as a musician, the more rewarding it is.
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact is that jazz is really popular. I mean, you performed in Italy, in France, Germany, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Japan even. Jazz seems to be more popular everywhere. But I think, don't you, that it's gaining a resurgence here?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, like, how jazz has survived hard times already, right? So if it's not gone, it's not going to be gone anytime soon. It has something that like social media doesn't offer. Jazz has something that you can't TikTok, you know. jazz is the stuff of people communicating with each other and like being in the same room with each other and listening to each other and watching people interact in this way that is like conversation. But you can't put it into words, you know. I don't think that AI and robots can replace jazz. I feel good about that. You know, there's just a human thing here that we enjoy seeing each other play music with each other.
It's called riffing, and you know what? It's a good thing. Yeah. So let me ask you this before we leave this wonderful interview. What is your advice for anyone who wants to pursue music or jazz as, you know, beyond high school? What's your advice?
Sure. I think it's a balanced approach. It can't be all about you. It can't be all about creativity. It can't be all about discipline. It has to be about all of those things. You know, you have to work hard, but you also have to contribute something unique. You have to do the boring practice of the music, but then you have to play like you're crazy. You know, I mean, it's all of that. It's both the discipline and the creativity balanced out. You'd have to do the work and take chances at the same time. There's no perfect answer, you know, for what makes the next great musician. I just think that they all work really hard, and they also are not scared of expressing themselves and putting themselves out there and being risky with their expressions of like why we're here on this planet.
You know, this is why Pete, you are the director of jazz studies at State College of Florida, and you're young. How old are you?
At heart, or
you can tell me whichever one you want.
51 now.
Well, I would have guessed you at 30 from the pictures, honestly. But I want to tell you something. We cannot wait to see Pete Carney and Orange Alert at the Clearwater Jazz Holiday, which started in 1980. It's going to be doing its 2025. It is Back to the Roots in Coachman Park. Parting words, Pete, for those who are thinking about coming to Clearwater Jazz Holiday.
Yeah, I mean, we're planning an exciting show. I've been working on this show for 6 months. I can tell you that it's usually that I don't put on shows unless I'm going to put everything into it. And I always hire the best musicians that I can bring to the show and people that are going to play music that they care about and that you'll care about. You'll enjoy, have a good time, tap your toe, and it's upbeat, uplifting type of music and just a good feeling when you see our shows.
I can't wait to hear the sax roar. Thank you, Pete Carney, for being with us, and we appreciate your time. Folks, please go to Clearwater Jazz Holiday. We'll have all the information on our article. Pete, we thank you. We look forward to seeing you October 16th through 19th.